Intelligent Medicine is brought to you in part by Fullscript, my exclusive online supplement dispensary. Fullscript is the most trusted source for professional-grade supplements. It's safe, secure, and with Fullscript's refill reminders, it's totally effortless to stay on track with your supplement protocols. Go to drhoffman.com and click on the store to create your Fullscript patient account today. And if you're a healthcare provider, sign up for a free Fullscript dispensary account at fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. It's the easiest way for you to prescribe the exact supplement protocols your patients need. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about a subject of utmost importance to public health. And, you know, some might think that this is a concern that's peripheral to public health, because here on Intelligent Medicine, we talk about various diseases, we talk about high-tech and natural solutions. We call that Intelligent Medicine. But today we're going to talk about something that at first glance may not appear to be relevant to our subject of intelligent medicine, which is our current environment of media, social media, iPhones, their ubiquity, and their impact on our kids. Now, this story came to my attention because there was a story in the Wall Street Journal, you may have seen it last month, where an activist investment group, normally what they do is they go to board meetings, and sometimes they stand up and make a fuss about the governance or the financial direction that a company's making. But in an unusual move, JANA Partners, along with something called CalSTRS, which is the California State Teachers Retirement System, sent a letter to Apple urging it to develop new software tools that would help parents control and limit phone use more easily, and to study the impact of overuse on mental health. And with us today is one of the, shall we say, I wouldn't say necessarily instigators, but he's part of the brain trust that's behind this initiative. He's Michael Rich. He's an MD, also has a master's degree in public health, and he's an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He is also known as the mediatrician because his background is in pediatrics. He's founder and director of the Center on Media and Child Health. What a cool name. What a cool mission. He's a pediatrician, researcher, father, and he also has a career in media, interestingly. He came to medicine after a 12-year career as a filmmaker. And so he's media savvy, but he's also media wary. He's also conducting a study following a group of youth in a small New England city, comprehensively measuring their media exposure and related health and developmental outcomes. It's kind of like the Framingham Heart Study for kids with iPhones. I guess you could call it that in some ways, because they're following these kids year after year to see if it's having a major impact on their health. And so I can't think of a better person to address this issue than Dr. Michael Rich. Dr. Rich, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I know you've been very busy, because I've tried to get in touch with you, but your people were saying, oh, you know, he's doing something for 60 Minutes. He's talking to the Associated Press. You've been hither and thither and yon, very much in demand. So thanks for spending some time with us and our audience. So, tell us a little bit about this initiative from JANA Partners and CalSTRS. What's it about, and what are they trying to achieve?
Well, interestingly, to place this in historical context, I think it's no news to you or your listeners that people have had concerns about media exposure on kids really for half a century, since the 50s, when television became widely used in the United States. And unfortunately, in retrospect, what happened when people were concerned about the effects of, in that case, television on children's mental health, children's physical health, that we approached it as a values-based system, that children shouldn't see violence on television or shouldn't see nudity or drug use. And the problem with a values-based response is that that flies in the face of our freedom of expression rights, our First Amendment rights to say and listen to whatever catches our fancy. But what we're trying to do in this case is completely reframe this argument, not from one where the people concerned about kids are pitted in opposition to those who are concerned about freedom of expression, but to say we have science now that can help guide us to recognize that we are changed by the media we use and how we use them, and to help direct those changes in ways that are physically, mentally, and socially healthy for us. So this move is to not to say to Apple in this case, but really to all of the tech and media producers, not to say you are hurting our children, you are creating a bad product, but to say you guys are the best at what you do. Let's bring together this good science we have on child and adolescent development and integrate it in product development so that we are taking your product to the next level. We are making it better. Remember, these are investors who want to increase the value of their investment. And so they see this not as an attack on Apple so much as a challenge to, you know, expand and improve their product.
Well, there's a little bit of a perverse incentive here, because part of the mission of big companies like Apple and Samsung and the media giants like Google and Facebook and others, Twitter, is to get a lot of clicks, is to attract a lot of eyeballs, because they can monetize that via advertising and via revenues in terms of selling devices. And so, you know, on the one hand, you're telling these companies, okay, we're not threatening your livelihood, but on the other hand, we kind of want to put a little bit of a damper on rampant overconsumption of media, especially by our kids, because there's some real health consequences.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that that is part of what we're saying, but we're also saying to them that maybe this business of increasing clicks for the sake of it is not enough, particularly when we are seeing rising concerns among consumers about the effects on their kids and on themselves. So what we want to do is to say to them, don't be like the tobacco companies where you claim that you didn't know and just keep blindly searching for more clicks and more advertisers. Take a step back and say, you know what, let's integrate this and let's take care of our consumers while they are consuming our product, because that's the way we're going to build loyalty. That's the way we're going to, you know, decrease attrition. Because what's happening now is that those people who are concerned are basically getting offline themselves or taking their kids offline. And so that's a complete loss, as opposed to how can we redirect this product so that they don't feel that they have a choice between either using it at their risk or not using it at all.
So this is a health program, and the focus of our audience is primarily on health, their health, the health of their kids and their grandkids. So what are some of the major health consequences of, shall we say, screen addiction or screen overuse? Or what are some of the trends that, you know, you have a center on media and child health, and you're doing basic research on this subject. So what are you uncovering?
Well, we're not only doing basic research, we're also doing clinical care for media-related health issues. Mm-hmm. But I'll start sort of at the beginning, in the sense that the initial concern about this, really back in the television era, was, does screen time increase your risk for obesity? A very close second to that is, does watching violent media increase young people's aggression or young people's anxiety that they will be aggressed against? So we're looking at this interface between screens and physical, mental, and social health. Now, you use the term screen addiction, and I want to directly kind of fly in the face of that a little bit, because since the mid-1990s, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association have debated whether we should have a diagnosis called video game addiction first, then internet addiction. In China and Korea, there is a diagnosis of internet addiction disorder. They have hospitals, they have detox centers, et cetera. Literally now millions of kids that meet these diagnostic criteria. In our experience, first of all, we feel that all of the arguments between we academics about whether it should be called addiction or not is a waste of time and energy that is distracting us from looking at what's going on and taking care of it. We at the Center on Media and Child Health and at our new clinic for interactive media and internet disorders have taken a step back and said that all of these diagnoses are either inaccurate or incomplete. Internet addiction disorder is not only not an addiction because you can't measure physiologic change when either using or withdrawing, but it also is not restricted to the internet. You can be just as hooked on a console video game. So it's really the interactivity. We're calling it problematic interactive media use because it causes problems in their lives. And it
is impairment of social relations, impairment of health, impairment of educational attainment, et cetera.
Yeah, run the list. Exactly. We are approaching it because it presents problems in their lives. Another advantage of removing the word addiction from making it beyond making it more accurate is that when you hear the word addict, you think of bums on Skid Row or junkies in a shooting gallery with needles in their arms. You don't think of your 10-year-old who throws a hissy fit because he's got to turn off Minecraft and go to bed. What I, as a pediatrician, want to do is not only take care of those kids who have gone way down the slippery slope, but learn from them what predisposing and early signs are and help develop a strategy for prevention, for, you know, pediatricians and family practitioners and even school teachers and school guidance counselors to recognize the early signs of this and redirect when it's much easier to redirect than once they've dropped out of multiple schools, they're not waking up in the morning, et cetera, as some of the kids who are coming to see us are.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause for just a moment to let one of our sponsors share this message with you. As an Intelligent Medicine listener, you know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, professional grade, and effective. But vetting your sources and tracking down the exact products you need can be a hassle. That's why I use FullScript as my online dispensary, so I can send you, my patients and listeners, the exact products you need straight to your door by speedy delivery. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere. The best part? FullScript sends out refill reminders when you're running low, so it's totally effortless to stay on track with your supplement protocols. Go to drhoffman.com and click on the store to create your FullScript account, or ask your healthcare provider to sign you up for FullScript. If you are a healthcare provider, sign up for a free FullScript account at fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. FullScript is the most trusted source for professional-grade supplements. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant, and they offer world-class support. Get started at drhoffman.com and click on the store. Thanks for listening. And now back to today's guest, Dr. Michael Rich. Some of your data that you've compiled, and it's actually included in the open letter from JANA Partners and CalSTRS to Apple, a survey of 2,300 teachers, 67% said that students are negatively distracted by digital technologies in the classroom. 75% say students' ability to focus on educational tasks has decreased in the past 3 to 5 years since personal technologies have entered the classroom. 90% of these teachers surveyed said the number of students with emotional challenges has increased. And 86% said the number with social challenges has increased. And one high school teacher noted, quote, I see youth who used to go outside at lunch breaks, engage in physical activity and socialization. Today, many of our students sit all lunch hour and play on their personal devices. So I know these are subjective reports from teachers, but it seems to be having an impact on our educational system.
Certainly on the educational system. And if you think about it, you know, school and high school is where a lot of our social emotional learning and growth occur. And they're observing that as well. I think that what we're doing is we're kind of laying the foundation in Alberta, which is where this is done, the province of Alberta, Canada, to build into it this long-term Framingham Heart Study design to look at actually 3,000 kids, 1,000 each of preschoolers, school age, and adolescents, and follow them year after year using a smartphone-based methodology that not only looks at what they're using, but also what they're exposed to in the ambient environment, and looks over time at what changes in trajectory we see of development of health, etc., and see what we can tweak, what we can change in the way we are using media, which quite frankly right now is pretty much opportunistic and mm-hmm. without much thought to implications or long-term effects, and be much more mindful in our use and use these very powerful tools in ways that promote the better angels of our nature and hopefully mitigate some of the potential pitfalls.
Well, you know, I know parents are really in a quandary because I have a 2-year-old in my family, and already he gets really wild when there's an iPhone around or an iPad around. He gets his behavior really changes, and he really wants screen time. And he's starting to learn at the tender age of, you know, just 26 months. He's learning to swipe and to select cartoon videos that he wants to see. And so, you know, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Gay Paris, as they used to say, when, you know, the cat's out of the bag, the horse is out of the barn?
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, how many parents do you see who pull out a smartphone or a tablet and say, look how smart my infant is, who can, you know, touch the picture of the cow and make it say moo. Here's the dirty little secret. Every baby can do that. This doesn't show how smart your baby is. This shows how smart Steve Jobs was for creating this incredibly transparent interface between the human eye, finger, and mind to really integrate the machine learning and the human learning together. And what has happened, because so many of these very young kids are almost transparently adept at this, and parents look at, you know, their 5-year-old, their 13-year-old, and see them Snapchatting, etc., and they take a step back and they say, I am completely incompetent in this realm.
Right.
I'm not going there.
Right.
And so they do not parent their child in the digital environment. And the reality is, for these kids growing up, is there is no real world, virtual world separation for them. It is a seamless world for them. They move in and out of that. We need to parent them. We need to teach them in that environment just as much as we do in the physical world.
There's some data that suggests that teenagers who spend 3 hours a day or more on electronic devices are 35% more likely to have a risk factor for suicide. Those who spend 5 hours or more are, get this, 71% more likely. Is this causation or mere correlation? Are kids who are somewhat depressed and kind of involuted tending to spend more time with navel gazing into their devices?
Well, yes and yes, probably. I mean, we don't have enough data to really point to causation. But what we do know also, quite frankly, is that those kids who spend about an hour a day on social media are actually psychologically healthier than those kids who spend no time at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can't sort of say the direction is all bad. This is not like lighting up a cigarette. Mm-hmm. But
we're not talking zero tolerance for sure.
We're not talking zero tolerance. And also, we shouldn't even be talking about tolerance as the construct here. We should be approaching this more like nutrition and sort of saying, okay, we're not going to tell you don't eat, ever eat junk food, but we are going to tell you the difference between, you know, a hamburger and broccoli and how it's going to affect your body. You're going to make your own decisions, but we want you to do that in a knowledgeable and thoughtful way that gets you where you want to get. So I think that we need to take a step back from this values-laden, you know, sort of right and wrong or tolerate or intolerant of or restrict mode, because that just certainly creates friction and the potential for subversion with adolescents who will have a thousand
workarounds. Yeah, because kids will become deceptive. You know, they'll become secretive and deceptive, and they already have apps that sort of hide their online presence. They have Snapchat. Right. There's a new one. None of these I understand, of course, you know, but that's precisely the idea. You know, there's sort of these kids. It's like a unique secretive culture that the kids have. There's something called... Finstagram,
yeah.
Which is the hidden version of Instagram that's not susceptible to the prying eyes of parents.
Well, the F of Finstagram is fake. So people will have different identities on Instagram, and that's what Finstagrams are. Yes, kids will have an Instagram account that their parents know about and can get on if they let them, but they will often have other accounts. And this is in some ways, the natural outcome of doing the right, wrong, good, bad paradigm with this. And you know what? We should have learned this around cigarettes, you know, because when we did the right, wrong, good, bad thing, there were a significant minority of young people who said, if it's bad, I want to do it, you know, because I'm a badass.
Me at age 18. That accurately describes me. Yeah.
You know? Right, exactly. I mean, but this is normal autonomy-seeking behavior in an adolescent. When we got a handle on cigarette smoking in public health, and it's admittedly one of our great public health successes of the last half century, is when it became stupid and uncool, not when it was dangerous, et cetera. Even the black lungs in school didn't turn kids off. Same thing happened with the DARE program and drug use, which is that it basically made it less scary and it desensitized kids, so it actually ended up with kids being more experimental with drugs than they had been before they were exposed to it. So some interesting findings around human behavior in response to this, you know, making of it of the forbidden fruit, you know. Instead, we have to take a step back and do a couple things. The first is to not make it about good and bad, right and wrong, but about how are you being changed by this as an individual in your health, but also in your place in the world, how you are behaving with other people. Because what we're learning from our research is, in actual fact, we are dealing with three moving targets here and their convergence and their, you know, divergence as they progress. One being the developing child to adolescent to adult. The second being a rapidly evolving technological environment. And the third being our changing behaviors with these devices and applications. Look at how differently we behave with each other since we all have smartphones in our pockets. Mm-hmm. You know, you get on a bus, you get in an elevator, you do not look at each other, you look at your device. We cannot be without stimulus from the outside. And we cannot be in the heat of a direct, you know, look at someone next to us. We would much prefer to text them. You'll even see kids sitting next to each other at a table texting each other, right? Because that way mom and dad can't hear. But, you know, and then we get into the whole issue of the concept of privacy, which kids insist on. But kids think of privacy as so mom and dad can't see.
Right.
right? They don't think of privacy as something that you need to protect because you're creating a digital footprint that may be there and will be there when you apply for college or apply to a job, et cetera. So, I mean, we're dealing with such an a set of behaviors that are so integrated into our everyday lives that you can't just take sort of one angle through it and take a binary approach of either turn it all off or don't go there, et cetera. We need to really think of it, as I do, as an environmental health issue, much the way we think of the air we breathe or the water we drink, that we're not going to get away from it, but we need to be informed and to make informed choices as we progress through this rapidly evolving environment in which we are living and raising our children.
Okay, well, you've very nicely laid the groundwork for our discussion in part two of some of the things that specifically we can do. The JANA letter and Kalzer's letter to Apple urges them to take action. We want to know some specifics on what parents can do and what some of the media giants can do. I, for one, was very happy today that I had my cell phone with me, my iPhone, because I was stuck in an elevator for 20 minutes, and it was fine because it enabled me to catch up on my email and text some people, so I was okay with it. But maybe that could be problematic if we spend too much time with them, especially from the standpoint of our kids. We'll be right back with part two of our discussion with Dr. Michael Rich. He is the Associate Professor of Social and Behavioral Sciences at the Harvard School of Public Health, founder and director of the Center on Media and Child Health. And you'll be hearing lots more from him and from experts like him, because this is a debate that's going to really be shaping the future of our interaction with media. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.